From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Lee Stringer describes the 12 years he was homeless in New York, living under Grand Central Station. Eventually, he made a modest living selling and then writing for and editing Street News, a paper about the homeless. That led to a book contract, which led to a memoir. Now he has a new book, a conversation about writing with Kurt Vonnegut, who wrote the foreword to Stringer's memoir. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews In Honor of Duke, a new CD from pianist Marcus Roberts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal agents in Seattle are holding another Algerian man suspected of being involved in an alleged bombing plot. The suspect is being arraigned in federal court at this hour. From member station KUOW, Orlando de Guzman reports.
The suspect, Abdel Hakim Tesejra, was arrested in Washington State on Christmas Eve and is being detained by the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the FBI. Officials expect to charge him with illegally entering the U.S. Additional conspiracy and bomb-related charges are under investigation. Federal officials are trying to determine if Tesejra has connections with Ahmed Rassam, who was arrested on December 14th while smuggling military-grade explosives through a ferry crossing on the Washington State-Canadian border. Authorities have said Rassam was part of a wide-ranging and well-organized plot by Algerian terrorists to punish the United States. Soon after Rassam's arrest, there were fears that he may have had an accomplice who got off the ferry undetected. Orlando de Guzman, NPR News, Seattle.
President Clinton helped launch a second round of talks between Israel and Syria today, calling it a historic opportunity for peace. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Syria's Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa met with the president at a conference center near Shepherdstown, West Virginia. The White House was cautious about the prospects for an agreement. Spokesman Joe Lockhart said it's unrealistically optimistic to think the two sides can agree on major issues in this round, but it's important to start. Among the key issues to be discussed are security guarantees for Israel and how much of the Golan Heights Israel is willing to restore to Syria in exchange for peace. At least 17 people have been killed and dozens wounded by a bomb explosion in Indian-controlled Kashmir. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from New Delhi.
The explosion tore through a vegetable market on the outskirts of Srinagar. At least two security men were killed and several more were among the wounded, but most of the victims appear to be civilians. Kashmiri separatists have been fighting a decade-long insurgency against security forces in Indian-administered Kashmir that has left an estimated 25,000 people dead. The Kashmir conflict was at the center of last week's hijacking drama that led to the release by India of three militants being held in Indian jails in exchange for the 155 passengers and crew aboard the Indian Airlines plane. In a written statement, India's Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee today accused neighboring Pakistan of being behind the hijacking. India says the five hijackers were Pakistanis, but has so far offered no proof. Pakistan denies any involvement. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, New Delhi.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 140 points to close at 11,356. Declines led advances by 2-1 in heavy trading of 920 million shares. This is NPR News. Immigration officials in Seattle have detained 12 people from Hong Kong suspected of trying to slip into the country illegally in a cargo container. The case appears similar to two cases last week in which dozens of would-be immigrants were arrested after emerging from cargo containers in Los Angeles and Long Beach, California. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Bradley delivered a speech in New Hampshire today in which his campaign billed as his vision for a new millennium. New Hampshire Public Radio's Av Harris reports.
Bradley's speech focused mostly on domestic policy priorities, though he did note changing global realities such as the rise of the internet. But the former New Jersey senator says his main goal if elected president would be to restore people's faith in government.
For the intractable problems of our society, broken schools, children without guidance, the chronically poor, those without health insurance, the epidemic of guns, we need to turn these national problems into public issues that inspire the idealism of the American people.
Bradley did not mention his primary opponent, Al Gore, but made a veiled reference to the vice president when he said that only those who have embodied the ways of Washington do not seek bold solutions to national problems. For NPR News, I'm Av Harris in Concord, New Hampshire.
U.S. manufacturing kept growing in December, but at a slower rate than most analysts had been predicting. The National Association of Purchasing Management said its business index registered 55.5%, slightly lower than in November, but well within the range of an expanding economy. The reading indicates the economy is on track to exceed the record for the longest continuous expansion. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lee Stringer was homeless in New York for 12 years, starting in 1985. During most of that time, he lived underneath Grand Central Station. He eventually made a very modest income selling and then writing for and editing Street News, a newspaper about the homeless. That led to a book contract, which led to the publication of his 1998 memoir, Grand Central Winter, Stories from the Street. His memoir has been published in paperback with a new afterword, and he has a new book called Like Shaking Hands with God, a conversation about writing between Stringer and Kurt Vonnegut, who wrote the foreword to Stringer's memoir. Vonnegut wrote, "Like Jack London, Stringer is a self-educated storyteller of the first rank and an unembittered, hopeful survivor of extreme poverty, long-term homelessness, and addiction." Stringer now lives in a house in a working-class neighborhood in Westchester, New York, upstairs from his mother. He's still writing, mostly freelance articles and essays for anthologies. I asked him if the world operates on a different clock than it did when he was homeless.
I still tend to resist anything imposing its own pace on me. I still seem to jealously guard my own clocks and internal clocks and signals, and much like I did on the street.
And my impression of homelessness would be that, you know, there'd be this like endless day, no deadlines, no alarm clock, no job to get to. But how did the day divide? What was your clock like on the street?
You actually get onto new deadlines for different reasons. When I was there, in order to do what I had to do, first of all, there were two deadlines. The first deadline was I happened to be addicted to crack cocaine, and that has definite demands in terms of time and space and energy, and it needs money. So I used to support myself either by selling street news or picking up cans, and that had a schedule to it. So I would wake up at the crack of maybe 11 o'clock in the morning and start going around the station to get the lunch crowd, the cans from the lunch crowd. And then I would, in the summer, I'd work my way out of the station up Madison Avenue, around Central Park, and come back down and then hit the rush hour. And then at the end of the rush hour, take the whole miserable mess out to Queens where they had the machines and feed them to the machines, and then I'd have my $30, $40. So I had, I think we all tend to routines of one form or another.
Are these recycling machines that you take the cans to?
Yeah, because though the law, demands that each store accept without notice, I think 240 cans. Most of the stores did not like the sight of homeless people in their stores, so they threw obstacles in the way. Like you couldn't come in with a big black bag, or they said, "Well, you can come in, but you have to wait." And then you'd wait outside, and they just forget you were there, or they'd buy a machine, and then when you came, they'd unplug the machine and said it's out of order. It was an endless ruses. But out in Queens, one of the King Cullen and Pathmark stores just put a bank of machines in there. And we would all end up in there at night. It was like Las Vegas. People feeding the machine and the money dropping out. It was quite vivid. You had six of these lined up. and guys with black bags lined up behind it. It was really bizarre, a bizarre, almost surreal thing.
Well, I'm sure when you're carrying one of those big black bags with the cans in it, it's like wearing a sign saying, "Hi, I'm homeless and I need the money desperately," yeah. Right? Would people look at you differently when you were carrying those cans? Because it is like wearing a sign saying that you're homeless.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I go into this in the book. I became pretty adept at rendering other people invisible out of necessity. It'd be very hard to maneuver, to stand erect, as it were, in considering what the average person you passed was thinking of you. So as almost a survival mechanism, I found it necessary to find ways to just blur them as background.
How would you do that?
I don't know. I would just, I don't know if I had a particular technique. I wouldn't focus my, I would be inner focused, I think, is the way I do it. Other times I found that you can, through force of personality and sort of spirit, you can totally wipe all that out. It's just a matter of you yourself, where you're coming from, and how you feel about yourself. I found that if I felt good about myself and felt I had as much right to be doing whatever I was doing as the next fellow, then it was almost beside the point. My circumstances almost became besides the point.
Was it easy to feel good about yourself in the days when you were homeless and addicted to crack?
Sure. Sure, because, this is one of the things I absolutely discovered having been through it, is that there's nothing runs along one line. You know, even in the darkness, let's put it this way, in the deepest darkness, the light is much more clear and vivid. So that there would be, I could see destructive, perhaps, things about my personality, but I could also see the more redemptive things. And I realized that they're always there in everyone, and that it's the whole, you know, this concept of somebody being worthy or unworthy of our consideration is flawed, because nobody's that monolithic.
In the days when you were addicted to crack and you really needed the money,
uh-huh,
and you needed it at regular intervals so that you could get more crack. Did you ever turn to crime to get it? Ever steal?
In the end, in the book, I almost do it and I don't. But I do say in that chapter that I know I will eventually do this. And eventually, and this is what ended my, this is when I got to the point where I said, well, I don't want to do this anymore. I eventually was sent to the bank a few times with a friend's card to get money for her. She was a woman whose house I was staying out at, who now passed on, by the way. And she was one of the writers, and we were friends. And when Street News lost its office space, when I later worked for Street News, she invited me to stay with her and work on the book, which I did. But she liked to drink, and I liked the drugs, and she really wanted a drinking buddy, and was an accident waiting to happen. And one day, after going to the bank for her, I went outside and bought what I thought was some real deal, which turned out to be fake. And on my way back, I reached in my pocket and realized that I had not returned the card. And so I told myself, well, I'll just go to the takeout a little and I'll replace it. That was the lie I told myself, and ended up taking tons of money. There's an addendum to this story, though, because when I, about a year or two later, I was finished with my first part of treatment, and I was clean and sober, and I came to visit her, and had an opportunity at one morning. I was there, and she said, can you help me get into a detox? And I helped her get into a detox, and she did the work, and she gave up alcohol. So that was a nice amends to make, and then I later actually was able to give her back her money. So it was a tidy story.
My guest is Lee Stringer. He was homeless in New York for 12 years. For a while, he supported himself selling and then writing for the homeless publication Street News. Then he wrote a memoir, which was very well received, called Grand Central Winter, Stories from the Street. That's come out in paperback. And there's a new book now called Like Shaking Hands with God, which is a conversation about writing between Lee Stringer and Kurt Vonnegut. Lee Stringer, how did you become homeless in the first place?
Well, to paint you a picture, it's the middle of the 80s, okay? I'm living on the Upper West Side. I have a little business called Lee Graphics, do graphic design. And some money's coming in, and from all outwards and appearances, you might say I was at least en route to some success. I certainly had gotten a few of the baubles we're all encouraged to pursue in life. But the problem was, the first problem was that none of this was doing for me anything like near what I thought it would. It wasn't challenging me. It wasn't satisfying me. It wasn't fulfilling me. And I also knew that it wasn't a matter of scale. It wasn't a matter of getting, you know, more money or a bigger apartment. Or I knew that wasn't going to do it. There's a Spanish proverb that sort of encapsulates the feeling, and it goes, I don't want the cheese. I just want out of the trap. And that's how I felt. But it was the middle of the 80s, and there wasn't very much in evidence to suggest that there was any other thing to do. It was all about buying more and acquisitions and acquiring and upscaling and making money, and it was almost your patriotic duty to rev that economy up. And so that was totally oppressive to me, but I didn't really have any kind of pioneer spirit to jump out and try and do something else. So I was sort of this, it's a phrase of the 60s, I was sort of doing this quiet desperation thing. Enter, well, one day my partner goes out and has a heart attack. And then my brother shows up a few weeks later, near death, and he dies. And then my father died. And they're trying to, it was my partner's apartment, and suddenly the apparatus, the machinery that I had set up for this life began to uncrank itself. And about a year after those events, I just ran out of steam.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't maintain anymore. And I felt, because it was the 80s, I don't know if this is ridiculous, but I felt it was unconscionable to be idle. I thought, what a moralist being I'm being, and I doused that with drinking. I don't think I became a full-blown alcoholic, but I hit that cocktail hour heavy. And then in the midst of this, depression came on. In the midst of that, I was a bar buddy introduced me to a little white rock. And next thing I know, and I mean, that seemed like the cure, because one hit of that and I was ready for the 80s again. I wanted to be out there with the cash and the flash and, you know, I wanted to do the whole glitz thing. And you flash forward and burned up what was in the bank, lost my job, and Marshall shows up after 4 months in arrears and says, do your talking, walking.
You're evicted?
Yep. But the thing was this, that two things that was very peculiar, and this, we go into it in the book, is that that moment I felt relieved because I had constructed my own trap. I had constructed this apparatus of a life that was giving me nothing, and now I didn't have to keep maintaining that. And it also strangely occurred to me in the back of my mind that, now at least I'll see some new possibilities.
Right.
It was a very peculiar reaction, but that was what, it wasn't what at all what I thought my reaction would be.
Mm-hmm. Well, once you lost your home, mm-hmm. what was the first place you went to get a
night's sleep? I remember that distinctly. I walked down, I was on 2nd Avenue, walked to the, what's that throughway over there? To the highway over there, and sat there. It was summer, and smiled. It was the weirdest thing. Completely smiled, and then till I got hungry. But there happened to be a soup kitchen right around the corner, and I did that a few days, And then one day, the strangest thing, I had this, when I got hungry, I thought of Häagen-Dazs ice cream and Pepperidge Farm cookies. That was the thing that kept popping in my mind. And so I was determined to get some. So, and they don't have that at soup kitchens.
No.
Not into any I went to. And so I started the can thing. I thought, well, all I got to do is pick up about 60 cans, 70 cans, and I can go to the supermarket and get this stuff. And that's how I started my career in the reclamation and recycling of semi-precious metals.
My guest is Lee Stringer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lee Stringer. His memoir about the 12 years he was homeless is called Grand Central Winter. When you became homeless, it was the mid-80s, and this was a period of a growing number of people becoming homeless. And there was a period, I think, when you were able to sleep in the waiting room at Grand Central Station?
Yeah, that was, if it was first, it was like a dream, then it became a nightmare. At first I thought, well, this is really hip. I mean, what better use of a public place than to house what had become, in effect, public people? I thought, this is an amazing city. But that soon, partly because of the faults of the people living there and partly because of the reactions of the people who had businesses in there, it became an ugly adversarial thing.
So after you could no longer sleep in the waiting room at Grand Central, where'd you go?
I found my way to a stairs in the lower level on one of the platforms. I slept under there for a while, and then they found me there. And I had to do cat and mouse for a while. And then one day I was on the side of the... I jumped down on the track bed to get something I'd stashed there, and I see that the platform is hollow. And I saw a little window in there, and I peeked inside, and there's this long crawl space about 4.5 feet tall, and it had light and running water. And I thought to myself, ooh, a condo.
Did you settle it?
And I moved in there and lived there for about 8 or 9 years.
So how'd you furnish it, so to speak, and what'd you do for lighting?
Well, IKEA wasn't open then. So I furnished it. I didn't furnish it much. I piled, clothes and stuff, because it's a concrete floor down there, and every soft thing I found in a mast I put under there, and I had books down there, and slept down there and read down there. One night I was down there, and I heard someone jump from the tracks to the track bed, and I put the light out, unscrewed the bulb, and then the footsteps came closer, and then I hear a lighter flicking, and then this arm comes thrusting through the window with a wad of newspaper on fire as a torch, and then this is a black arm, and then this black head comes in there, and it was this African guy, and he says, "Hello, I am your neighbor. I am on track 111. I wonder if you have any books." And so, books on my TV. And so I would lend him books. He'd come over and borrow books because I had tons of books. I used to find books all over the place while searching for cans. And they were indeed my TV. I had a wide variety. I had quite a wide variety in my little library there.
I was reading an article in the New York Times about how crimes against the homeless are on the rise, violence against the homeless is on the rise around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently most of the attackers are teenage males who are not homeless themselves, but who do this kind of for sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you came across that yourself in your years on the street.
I didn't come in across any particular personal violence predicated on the fact that I was homeless. None. And that's my experience. Not that it wasn't out there, but I think I do see that it did happen, and I do sort of see some of what it's come out of. You know, since the 80s, we sort of are less tolerant of the of human beings in the respect that we're less and less tolerant of people who stumble, who lose their way. And that is beginning to solidify to awesome proportions today. And I can see where that, you know, there's a certain political mileage to be gotten out of, particularly to people who want to trim budgets for the fat cats. There's a certain amount of mileage to be gotten out of saying, well, look, this, you've got to work every day, and look at these people. So that opens the door to a whole bunch of hostility.
There are a lot of people on the street who are very desperate. They don't mm-hmm. have money. They need mm-hmm. money to feed a habit, or they need
right.
money
right.
just for food to stay alive.
Right. Right.
Some of the people on the street are mentally ill.
Yes.
Some of the mentally ill are violent. Some of them
right.
are not violent at all.
Right.
Who are
all
you
of
most...
could be said of any group of people, by the way. That's
yeah.
my point.
Well, who are you most concerned with? I mean, I think anybody walking down the streets of New York is like looking over their shoulder. You know, everyone in New York is a little, and in most major cities, is a little concerned about crime. Who are you most concerned about? The homeless, the not homeless, the mentally ill, not the mentally ill? Who? I'm sure you develop some kind of sixth sense about...
Well, I mean, and this is the process of writing has opened my eyes to this, and that's simple. I'm concerned about man. These subcategories are so absurd. They are walls. This is the way I'm trying to look at life. I'm trying not to segment people. And I find that in doing so, the world gets bigger and I get bigger. And it's a nicer world. So I haven't chosen a group to be a fan of. I'm a fan of all of us. I hope we all make it through this struggle with something intact. Every morning I cheer all of us on in that regard.
Lee Stringer will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Sisiv, building custom e-business systems for global 2,000 companies worldwide. On the web at CYSIVE.com. From Dell, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer. Counting Carbs, a book that counts carbs, fats, and proteins for people watching what they eat. Available in bookstores. And from the Industry Standard and thestandard.com, providing today's business executive with intelligence on the internet economy. On the web at www.thestandard.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, from living under Grand Central Station to getting a book deal, we continue our conversation with Lee Stringer. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD from pianist Marcus Roberts.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lee Stringer. In 1985, after being evicted from his apartment, he was homeless. For most of the next 12 years, he lived underneath Grand Central Station in New York. His 1998 memoir has been published in paperback. It's called Grand Central Winter, Notes from Life on the Street. And he has a new book, A Conversation with Kurt Vonnegut, about writing called Like Shaking Hands with God. One of the stories you tell in your memoir, Grand Central Winter, I thought was a pretty frightening story. A guy, middle-class guy, on the way back from work maybe, stumbles into a place in Grand Central or one of the train stations where there's a bunch of homeless people living. And he's kind of shocked to discover this. And then basically everybody seemed really ready to take advantage of him in whatever way they can.
Well, it wasn't everybody.
Well, it wasn't you and your friend. But
No, it was just two guys.
It was just two guys?
It was two guys.
Oh, okay.
You know, I tell the complete story. This is a guy out after of a night of sniffing coke with his girlfriend, a pretender to yuppiedom. I mean, there's a lot of things going on
right
here. And to just, and the error is to look at that as a homeless and not homeless guy. You miss everything important. It's because everybody in that story had different motivations for different reasons. They were in different points in their lives. And that's the whole thing of the story. And so, and these things collide. Well, we live in a city where lives are lived. And lives will, no matter, you can give us wall-to-wall Giuliani's, lives collide. That's called life. You know, and this is a story about these lives that have collided, and I thought it was, the way it played out was infinitely interesting, and it taught me something.
What did it teach you?
It taught me something about what we call heroism, that we throw the word around far too easily, and that there probably is no such thing. Probably the one thing we all humans cannot not do is act on behalf of our own self-interest as we perceive it. Now, I've had this argument. In fact, I made this argument once. Well, what about the guys who give you the shirt off their back and ask nothing in return? Well, they just happen to have a healthy perspective on what is in their self-interest. They realize that it is in their self-interest to help their fellow man.
Wait, so you intervened when two of the homeless guys were going to try to mug this guy.
I didn't intervene. My friend intervened, and I joined in once he did that.
Mm-hmm. And what was your self-interest?
My self-interest was that we were sleeping there, and if this guy got mugged and another guy got mugged, we were sleeping on the ramp in front of Grand Central. And this is before I moved into this
condo.
we'd all get kicked out of there. We'd have to sleep in the cold. There's also the possibility of maybe he'd be grateful and give us something. There's all these thoughts went through my head.
You know, I'm wondering, when you were living in the subways and in Grand Central, the subways in New York have become incredible, and this is probably particularly true in the late 80s and in the first part of the 90s. It was like performance art. Where, you know, someone was always walking through the train giving you, like, their little performance about what had gone wrong in their life and why they needed you to give them money right now. And some people would do it with humor, and other people would do it with this implied threat that you could either give them money or they could go out and mug the next person they see. What was your reaction to watching all of these performance art kind of ways of hitting people up for money?
Having worked in the advertising business, I knew what that was all about. It's just not legitimized, but it was interesting to see that all the techniques used by Madison Avenue were used by these guys, and Madison Avenue is not above threatening you or not above questioning your self-worth and not, so I was fascinated by this native talent, and I said, gee, you know, some of these guys, advertising people should snatch these folks up. All it'll take is a little training and they'll be relentless. And as a matter of fact, one day while I was giving my pitch on the train, a guy from Hal Reiney, I think it is. They did the Perrier commercials. Mm-hmm. If the sun hadn't come down on Wednesday, and if the waters of the, you know that commercial?
I don't.
Hal Reiney, the Perrier commercial, gave me a card and said, "We want your voice."
You're kidding. Huh? What was your pitch?
My pitch was, "Hi, folks. I thought perhaps some of you might enjoy something interesting to read, so I brought along a copy of this." And then I tell a little bit about it, and I say, "And if any of you would like a copy, please know that I'd be very happy to serve you."
And this was Street News?
This is Street News.
And Street News was a publication, like a small newspaper published and written by the homeless.
Right, and sold by the homeless. Not necessarily written by the homeless. And towards the end, that became the option when there was less money.
Right.
The thing is, people work out of their reality. In other words, I didn't panhandle because, not because I have any particular better character than the next fellow, but because it was not part of my reality. I did not believe that people would just give me money because I asked for it. That wasn't part of my system. I didn't just believe this would happen. The people who use the harder pitch, you know, the guys who say, you know, we're not robbing or stealing, you know, and it sounds like a threat, and it does have an implied threat. But the other side of that is they understand how they're perceived. See, we're missing that. They understand this and that we're going to be perceived that way until they do something active to oppose this assumption that just happens to be the case at this time in life. So these, and I'm talking particularly about black people, you know. It's very often that we don't come into people's consciousness quite as often, unless it's some bad news, you know. I mean, the average black guy sitting in Harlem may not expect to get into our consciousness unless he holds up a liquor store or gets arrested. So that sort of conveys a certain message that settles into the psyche. And it takes some active act to begin to dislodge that. So that's the other half of that equation. The other half of that, I'm not robbing your house, is saying, well, don't just look at me the way I know you're looking at me.
Did you ever use an implied threat when you were selling Street News?
No, if I figured I'd threaten somebody, I figure, why imply? But no, I didn't use it. I didn't do it because that wasn't out of my experience. I had gotten to, having been in advertising, I had learned that the thing you do when you sell is you don't talk about your product, you talk about the needs of your customers. So I would get on, I mean, here are people on the train, they're pushed, they're shoved, they're ignored, they're hot, they're sweaty. And I had one pitch I'd come on and says, hi, folks, I know it's been a long day. I know you were, you know, it's, you don't want to hear me, so I'm not going to give a big pitch. I just want to say. And that worked because, you know, it's kind of nice to get on a train where you're being pushed and shoved and annoyed and you're late. And somebody says, you know, I know what you're going through.
A little bit of empathy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
More effective than a threat in that situation.
Well,
it's more effective
just,
for you.
I don't know what it's effective. It just fits into what I know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
See, we tend to judge others with an omnipresent view, that we presume everybody knows everything that they need to know to do what they have to do, or they know what we know. And if you look at, if you tear down those walls I was speaking of, you begin to see that people act out of what's been given to them. They act in their self-interest with the information they have. And we're mostly given part of the picture, not the whole picture. And we operate on that part of the picture.
My guest is Lee Stringer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lee Stringer. His memoir about the 12 years he was homeless is called Grand Central Winter. Now, you eventually wrote a column for Street News. And wrote,
Ask Comey.
What was the turning point in actually deciding to write a memoir? Were you still homeless when you started writing it, or was that after you got off
the street? Well, you've heard that I've got my job through the New York Times.
Yeah.
Well, I got my book deal through the MTA. There was a publisher by the name of Dan Simon on the subway one day, and he bought a copy of Street News from one of the vendors. Now, at this point, Street News wasn't so much something to read as it was an instrument of informed Samaritanism, the idea being to get the buck in the guy's hand. And few people read it. But Dan buys it, probably tucked it under his arm. The train goes into the tunnel and gets stuck for 20 minutes. So he looks around. Nothing. He pulls this out, and because the subway was stuck, he actually read the paper. And I, by then, was writing a good quarter of it. And he later told me his quote was, he said, the writing knocked his eyeballs out. And he got back, and he called my publisher and said he wanted to meet me. I went to meet him. He says, you might be interested in doing a book. And I said, something like humana, 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 humana. And then I thought, book, advance, money, crack. And I said, sure, I'd like to do a book.
Well, but did you use the money for crack?
I used the first installment, which I got. It was only $3,000 in payments of $500 a month. I talked him into making it $1,000 up front and $350 payments. And I knew just what I was going to do with that $1,000. And I was, you see, drug addiction doesn't describe the logic. You don't say, oh, well, here's an opportunity here. I think I'll stop doing drugs and pursue this opportunity and try and pursue some success. That logic has nothing to do with it. It's a whole psychology and physiology that's been set in that takes help. You need help and guidance and direction and specific things to rid yourself of. So that's one thing a lot of people don't understand who haven't been there. So, of course, for 10 years, the Pavlovian response is money, drugs, money, drugs. Why should it suddenly be any different? Only it was money, drugs, so, this time. But the good news on that is I went and I spent a weekend and had a whole weekend of just continuous getting high and whatnot. And at the end of it all, Monday morning, an hour away from when the staff would start coming in, and I'm living in Street News's office at this point, I wake up and the office is a shambles and I have no money left. And I knew two things. I said, well, one thing is I got to clean this office. And the other thing is now I got to write that book.
To get the rest of the money?
No, because I'd already spent the money. Now I owed the book.
Right.
That's what I really felt. I owed the book. And that's how I started. I mean, but the more I got into it, the more it became something else, not just paying off the debt and not just having a book that might earn me income. It became the final steps in what I think was a 12-year journey. These were the final steps. And it also coincided with my getting into the 12 steps and having a kind of what they call a spiritual awakening. And I think the book benefited from that because it's imbued with this. I don't even talk about it much, but people come to me and says, there's something so spiritual about this book. But I don't sit there and preach. It's just an undertone of, I felt at times imbued with light is the only way I could put it, a certain light.
When you were on the train and the guy from the advertising company said he wanted your voice, Did you ever take him up on it? Did you call him?
Now, there's the interesting thing. I was thrilled, and I just couldn't get to it because you know what job one was?
Scoring.
Job was getting high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just never got to it. And it's a good thing I didn't.
Why?
You know, I'm very blessed in a way because then money and notoriety would just empower me. I was in a negative place at that time. So it just exponentially increased that kind of self-betrayal and self-destructive behavior. When the book came out and I began to get royalties, this is how I'm blessed. I was finally in a place where it any other time would have thrown me. And it doesn't this time. For instance, the notoriety is certainly pleasant, but you know the trick is you can't wake up for that. You can't get up in the morning for that, because it'll take you to a place where you don't want to go. Same with the money. So, in a way, it was a good thing I never followed up in there, because I would have just probably maybe smoked myself to death. Who knew?
So, is writing now the meaningful work that you feel you were looking for all along?
To me, it's not meaningful work. I don't add the word work to it. It is work, but I mean, I don't say that in terms of, you know, having to be employed at a job to be legitimate.
Right.
But it's meaningful business in my life because it comes out of who I am. And I think everybody should have, and I think it's perfectly possible, should get up every day and go off to do something that's connected to who they are.
So I'm wondering now, when you walk down the streets of New York or you're in the subway and you get panhandled, what do you do?
I say, man, get a job. No, I don't say that.
Okay.
Well, you know, it depends on the day of the week and who it is and how they approach me. I try, you know, this is the way, this is called human intercourse. And so I keep it at that level. I'm fortunate to be able to do that. A lot of people, because of that homelessness has become an issue, want to create a personal policy. Well, when homeless people come to me, I will do this. And, you know, that's totally absurd. We're not governments. We're human beings. And what policy does is it abdicates anything human from happening. It means that this is the form I will apply to this situation irrespective of the person I'm facing.
So you just react on an individual level?
I react. Some people annoy me. I don't give them money. Some people don't annoy me. I give them money. Some people don't ask. I give them money. Some people I know they're going to get a hit. I may give them the money. I may not. At the bottom of every social issue, to me, there's a question. The simple question is, how, in an increasingly textured world, are we to reasonably exist? And, you know, the answer is, and always has been, we keep at it till we can.
Just one more thing. At the beginning of the interview, you were saying that you had to kind of mentally make the people around you invisible because...
At times, because...
If you really registered the looks that they were giving you, it would have been too disturbing. Were some of those looks victim looks, like, oh, that poor homeless person? Were they looks of pity and looks of fear?
You know, it wasn't so much what the looks were. It was their inability to see me that made the difference. And this is something...
You mean to just see a type?
Right. This is something I had prior experience with. I was raised black in America, so I have plenty of experience with that. And it's really, it's about not being seen, not being given the opportunity to see under certain circumstances, the most prevalent of which is the color of my skin, but later was the circumstances, you know, the thickness of my wallet.
Well, Lee Stringer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Lee Stringer's memoir, Grand Central Winter, is out in paperback. His new book, Like Shaking Hands with God, is a conversation about writing with Kurt Vonnegut. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by pianist Marcus Roberts. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Marcus Roberts came up as Wynton Marsalis's piano player in the 1980s. He emerged as a leader in the early 90s dealing with modern mainstream jazz, as well as historic styles like the stride piano of 1920s master James P. Johnson. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Roberts has kept refining that mix in recent years, and his music sounds better and more confident than before.
If there's one criticism Marcus Roberts must be sick of hearing, it's that his music is too serious. Someone as fond of Thelonious Monk's teasing piano style as he is has to have a sense of humor. Anyhow, the playful aspects of Roberts' new album are hard to miss. Case in point is the opening tune, Ricky Tick Time, where he shows you can take archaic styles seriously and still have fun with them, like the musicians who invented this stuff. Marcus Roberts' new album is a loose suite called In Honor of Duke. Ellington's image looms over Roberts on the cover, although Roberts insists that it is not a tribute to Ellington. Yeah, right. All the tunes are new, but he does kid a few of Duke's favorite piano licks, and like Ellington, he finds a full palette of moods and color in the trio format. That bass player is Roland Guerin, who gets a good plump sound and is handy with a bow. The drummer is Jason Marsalis, who drops New Orleans parade beats on the trio for some extra snap. I only wish he played or at least was mixed a little louder. In Marcus Roberts' liner notes, he rejects the traditional jazz trio hierarchy with piano on top and bass and drums in support. He favors a looser model where any member at any time can take the wheel and the spotlight. Equilateral trios are a good idea, but Roberts shouldn't give the impression it's a new one. Pianists and critics have talked them up for decades. Besides which, as in most such democratic trios, the piano is still first among equals. Thank you. Marcus Roberts is a stickler for musicians knowing their jazz history, so it's puzzling to read in his long notes that musicians who toured with Ellington admired and respected him, without noting some blistering exceptions, or that Duke refused to acknowledge trends or cater to the market. In fact, Ellington wrote cha-chas all through the 1950s and lots of rock and roll-flavored pieces in the 60s. Duke played way too many dances to ignore what dancers wanted. Now, Roberts' fuzzy history shouldn't be held against his music. It's not easy to fine-tune tempos on the fly or rifle through varied styles in a plausible way, as his trio does. But maybe if Roberts were more attentive to earlier equilateral trios, including Ellington's with Charles Mingus and Max Roach, or to pianists who brought older styles into a modern context by the 1960s, like Jackie Byard or Dave Burrell, he might discover some durable solutions to problems he sets for himself. Isn't that why musicians learn jazz history in the first place?
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Marcus Roberts' new CD in honor of Duke. We'd like to welcome the listeners of two stations that have just started broadcasting Fresh Air, WESM in Princess Anne, Maryland, and WNKU in Highland Heights, Kentucky. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shirock, with Monique Nazareth and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support from Universal Pictures, presenting Snow Falling on Cedars from Scott Hicks, director of Shine and based on the novel. Opens January 7th at theaters nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jason DeParle of the New York Times. He's been reporting on welfare for the past 10 years. He just concluded a year-long series monitoring the changes in Wisconsin, the state that has come closest to the goal of ending welfare. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.